Jeff Greeson is the Chief Deputy District Attorney for Sutter County in Northern California. He has extensive experience as a prosecutor and deputy DA, which has given him valuable insight into the criminal justice system in California, especially through legislative changes like the reduction of theft and drug crimes to misdemeanors back in 2014. I had the opportunity to discuss the trends in crime that he has seen over his 16 years of experience, as well as the increase in crime across California as a direct result of legislation. This was an incredible conversation that I know will be so beneficial and interesting to anyone who wants to know what issues are facing our state this election and how we can push forward common sense reforms. I'm your host, Tess Abraham, and join me for a fascinating discussion of crime in California on this special episode of the California Conversation. Hi, Jeff. Thank you so much for joining me today to discuss your experience, the state of crime in California, the trends you've seen as a result of legislation, and just so much more. I really appreciate you reaching out and taking the time to speak to my listeners about such important issues. To get us started, could you tell us who you are and what you do?
Sure. And thanks, Tess. I really appreciate the opportunity to address your listeners. It's a real privilege for me to be able to discuss these topics with them. My name is Jeff Greeson. I'm the Chief Deputy District Attorney of Sutter County. I started this current position in July. Prior to that, I was a Deputy District Attorney in Butte County. In those 16, coming up on 17 years now, I've prosecuted and taken to trial cases ranging from fish and wildlife misdemeanors, all the way up to special victims prosecutions and first-degree murder, special circumstance homicides. So I've really run the gamut. At any rate, I've been doing this for quite a while now and have had an opportunity to really see how criminal law has changed in these last 16 years and the impact of different laws and different court decisions as they've come across.
Wow, it sounds like you have extensive experience in criminal justice. Could you give us a little context about your counties? I know you said you worked in Butte County and now you work in Sutter County. Where are those located in California? And also, generally, what is life like for you there? For example, living in LA, I'm sure you know that we're a huge county and we're known for things like our film industry as well as fashion. Do Butte and Sutter counties have small towns or big cities? Are they agricultural? Are they more industrial? Could you give us some general context for where you're located?
Sure. So I still live in Butte County, even though I have to commute down to Yuba City every day. The big cities here in Butte County are Chico and Oroville and Paradise. Obviously, we have had a major change in population after the campfire that destroyed the town of Paradise. It was a pretty interesting thing to have. Literally, Chico has about 100,000 people, and we grew to 120,000 people over the period of about 48 hours when they evacuated Paradise.
Wow.
Yeah, it was quite an experience to go through. Mm-hmm. But Paradise is on the mend. They're rebuilding. Butte County is about 200,000 people. It's kind of an interesting breakdown because we have a lot of the urban type environment here in Chico, and then Oroville is a kind of a tourist town. But the rest of it, to the west, you're looking at orchards and rice paddies. But on the other hand, to the east, you get into the mountains, and you're dealing with very, very remote areas for hiking, hunting, fishing, things like that. Of course, Lake Oroville. Sutter County is a little different. Sutter County's got one major city, and that's Yuba City. All of Sutter County has about 100,000 people. So it's 120,000. So it's a little bit smaller than Butte County, mostly rural, mostly agricultural in Sutter County. A lot of rice paddies, again, a lot of orchards. And then in terms of the types of crimes, for both of them, we run the gamut. I was kind of surprised in Butte County, in particular, how the urban environment resulted in a pretty significant gang problem. Mm-hmm. That was the same thing, especially in this little town called Gridley, where there's a large group of migrant farm workers that live there. Sometimes their young folks fall into that gang lifestyle. Definitely it's something that we deal with in Sutter County as well. both communities are generally pretty safe. We don't have some of the kind of serious crime problems that you're going to have in some of the larger cities, but we do have them. And so definitely keeps me employed.
That's super helpful context. Thank you. Fun fact, I'm actually originally from San Joaquin County. I grew up in the Lodi-Stockton area, so you're located just above my neck of the woods. Now that we have that background, let's dive into your area of expertise, which is really about the legislation and events that got us to the point that we are today with Prop 47 in place.
Sure. Well, I've got to make sure I do, because I'm an attorney, I got to make sure I give my disclaimer. Yes. I'm here appearing, although my boss knows that I'm participating in this interview. I am not representing the County of Sutter, the District Attorney's Office of Sutter County, or the elected District Attorney, Jennifer Dupre. These are all my own opinions. Also, I am a lawyer, but I'm not your lawyer, so don't take anything I'm saying as legal advice. There you go. So as a lawyer, you got to go through those because you get in trouble if you don't.
Well, with that out of the way, take us back to before Proposition 47 was passed in 2014 and talk us through the various legislative changes that ultimately resulted in reducing these crimes down to misdemeanors. And then also, because you've been a prosecutor since before the proposition, maybe you could also speak to your personal experience as to what it was like to prosecute crime, both before and after it passed. For example, did it have an impact on your work? Did it have an impact on the crime you saw in your county? Just tell us everything.
Sure. Well, obviously, you're a younger person, so you didn't live through the crack wars of the late 80s and early 90s, but the crime problem in California was far, far worse than it even is today.
Really?
Yeah, the homicide rate was off the chart. And it was, the real big driver of that was the crack epidemic. As a result, in the early 90s, you had a bunch of legislative changes, including the California Three Strikes Law, which really put some teeth into what prosecution could do when you have people that are committing horrible crimes. Mostly it was focused on recidivists, or people who not made, you know, one bad mistake as a young person, but showed a pattern of criminal behavior and gave prosecutors and police some tools to really have a big impact on, if necessary, putting them in prison for a very long time. Mm-hmm. That some folks felt that the pendulum was swinging way too far towards incarceration. And there's obviously a whole different debate about that. But the folks in the legislature, we'll call them the criminal justice reform crowd, mm-hmm. were not happy with some of the results of the number of people wound up being incarcerated in California. there was concerns that they had a heavier impact on certain communities, especially Black and Hispanic communities, mm-hmm. And the population of the California, at the time, Department of Corrections. Now it's changed to the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. But at the time, it was the CDC, was just overflowing. There was a court case that started up in the mid-2000s called Brown v. Plata, where as far as I know, this has never happened before in California, but there was never happened before in the United States, but a panel of three judges wound up appointing a administrator or a czar, the federal receiver was his actual title, to oversee the entire California prison system. This person's job was to ensure that some of the problems that came out of this litigation were being addressed due to the overcrowding primarily. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the court had found that the healthcare system in the prison, in particular mental healthcare system, had fallen so far below an acceptable level that it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. So, the court had ultimately found that the level of care, particularly with mental health care, had fallen below a standard that ultimately they deemed to be a violation of the Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment. Mm-hmm. And so the federal receiver's job was to monitor what was going on at CDCR and ultimately report back to the courts. The courts then had the authority basically to order California to change the way they were doing things. And so the orders coming from the court through the receiver were spend more, spend more, spend more, build more, build more. And if the state didn't do that, then they could be found in violation of a court order. this state of affairs went back and forth for quite a long time. And the writing was on the wall that ultimately was not going to be successful in getting to where this three-judge panel wanted it to go. So Brown v. Plata, or I can't remember. It started off, I believe, as Brown v. Plata and then became Plata v. Brown when it went to the Supreme Court. I may be getting that backwards. Ultimately, went before the United States Supreme Court, and in a 5-4 decision, ultimately ordered California to slash its prison population. Mm-hmm. When it was, again, 5-4 decision, the dissents, specifically by Judge Thomas and Judge Scalia, or Justice Thomas and Justice Scalia, were very scathing and predicted a lot of what ultimately did happen here in the state of California. Mm-hmm. So in order to create a mechanism for implementing the court's order, the legislature passed AB 109. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a history lesson here, mm-hmm. or background in criminal law, is that there's been three kinds of criminal laws. Your infractions, when you get caught rolling through red light, then that's just going to be a fine. The next level up in severity is a misdemeanor, and that can actually result in jail time. Traditionally, a misdemeanor had to be 1 year or less. A felony is anything that can result in imprisonment for 1 year or more. In California, prior to the passage of AB 109, all felonies that resulted in a prison commitment resulted in the defendant being sentenced to CDCR, to the state prison. And all the misdemeanors were handled locally at the county jail. Mm-hmm. After AB 109, broad categories of felonies were no longer eligible to be housed in CDCR. This created a new type of confinement called county prison, where inmates, rather than going off to state prison, would stay locally in the counties where they had committed their crimes, and could actually get quite a long sentence. I remember seeing sentences of 15 or 17 years in that county prison. Wow. But the county jails, those facilities were not designed to handle the needs of inmates over that long of a period of time. Right. So as a result, those longer sentences resulted usually in a much shorter period of confinement, maybe 6 months or a year, followed by what's called mandatory supervision, where they might be out, and depending on their level of dangerousness or needs, they might get an ankle monitor, they might get ordered to, you know, be in house arrest at their house and allowed to go to work, but some level of supervision in the community. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a very different situation being sentenced to a long jail or prison sentence. This also had the follow-on effect of, with all the county prisoners that were being stored in the local county jail, there was far less room for misdemeanors. So what happened is a lot of the lower level crimes, rather than actually spending meaningful time in county jail, they'd have to let them go because there just was no room. Right. When you've got, you know, a gang shootout where you got to arrest 10 people and you bring them to the jail, but it's all full of people that had gotten busted for relatively low level crimes, mm-hmm. you got to let them out in order to make room for the more serious people. Before Prop 47, there was a section called Penal Code 666, which, you know, an ironic number. Penal Code 666 was someone who had committed two petty thefts and had been convicted of them, and the third and subsequent one could be charged as a felony. Okay. And before AB 109, not only was it a felony, it was a state prison felony. Mm-hmm. So that third or fourth or fifth conviction, you could actually spend up to 3 years in big boy jail, mm-hmm. basically the prison. Along comes AB 109, and 666 now is only eligible for housing in the county jail. Again, up to 3 years, but practically not really. But then along comes Prop 47 and changes. So 666 is now only a misdemeanor, unless someone's committed a grand theft, which is over $950. Then along comes Prop 47. And Prop 47 converted a lot of crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. Before Prop 47, personal use quantities of drugs were either a felony or a misdemeanor. We call it a wobbler. And the way it works is someone would get busted. They would send the reports to our office, and we'd take a look and try to figure out, well, is this a young person who made a mistake, or maybe an addict who needs treatment, or is this mm-hmm. someone who has really got a problem that we need to charge with a felony in order to get that heavier layer of supervision? people who wind up on probation based on a misdemeanor conviction have very little supervision. For most people, it's just keep the court informed of where you live. That's kind of about it. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a felony, you've got a probation officer, you've got a report, they have a drug testing regimen where, you know, a couple times a week or month, whatever, that you're going and drug test. So someone who needs that more attention would typically get the felony. Also, there are certain enhancements to a sentence that only apply to felonies. So if there you, even though you might charge a relatively low level felony, if the person had a really bad criminal history, you could add these enhancements in order to add time if they were to go to prison, or basically add more consequences if they're going to get probation. So if they got the bigger hammer over their head, should they fail in probation? Mm-hmm. Once something is only a misdemeanor, all those enhancements go away. The maximum mm-hmm. they're going to spend is 1 year in county jail. The maximum probation period would have, a couple of years ago, it was only 3 years. And along with that change meant there was a lot less supervision for especially people who were abusing drugs, people who were committing low-level thefts.
Wow, that's a lot of helpful background in understanding how we got to this point in California criminal law. Just to recap for my listeners, it sounds like it all began with the crack wars back in the 80s and 90s when there was high crime in California, which then led to harsher enforcement like the three strikes laws. Some opponents saw this as too harsh. Over time, certain problems like prison overcrowding led to court intervention. And then that's how we got to the point where you said we changed Penal Code 666, and then eventually to the passing of Prop 47. You also referenced some effects you saw right away. Can you tell us more about the immediate aftermath of Prop 47?
Immediately after the passage of Prop 47, we started seeing people going through Walmart or Home Depot with calculators.
Really?
And as they're placing items in their cart, they're adding up how much it is to make sure they stay under $950.
Wow.
Yeah, they'd get it up to $850, $900 and then try to run for the door, knowing mm-hmm. full well that if they got caught and the police were called, they were looking at a petty theft. With a petty theft, you're looking at a maximum of 90 days in jail.
What? 90
That's
days?
Right. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And even then, that's a maximum. Mm-hmm. Another quirk about California law is that when you're in jail, you actually get, it's called day for day credit, meaning that as long as you're behaving yourself, mm-hmm. Every day you serve, you get credit for 2 days, meaning that a 90 day actually only means 45 days of actual commitment. And that would be the maximum.
Wow.
That also, by the way, goes for felonies. So that's why when you hear about someone who was sentenced to prison for 10 years mm-hmm. and then 6 years later, they're back out and getting busted again, mm-hmm. that's because of that. It's called good time credit.
Wow.
The system kind of makes sense because without that, there's nothing that the prison or the jail can do in order to enforce good behavior. Mm-hmm. So when they're in jail, if they're not behaving and doing things they're supposed to, they can take away that conduct credit.
Yeah.
So that's the logic to it. But it also means that people are spending a lot less time than the public thinks they're going to. Mm-hmm. They're thinking 10 years means 10 years. No, it means five. At any rate, once Prop 47 comes along and brings up that minimum to $950 and then eliminates Penal Code 666 as a felony, mm-hmm. that means every day someone can go to the store and steal as long as it's less than $950, and they're only going to be charged with petty theft.
Yeah. And it really pulled the backing of the law like away from you or from police, like law enforcement, because you can't really do anything even if they arrest them, like you're saying, they come in and you can't really sentence, like the judge can't sentence them with much time. So there's not really incentive to even bring them in and like arrest them.
That is one of the follow-on effects is that the morale of the different police forces, it's like, why am I going to waste my time arresting this guy? Because when I get back to write my reports, before I even get done writing my report, they're going to let him out of the jail. They're going to give him a court date. And then because the type of people that tend to participate in those kind of crimes have other social problems with addiction or homelessness, mm-hmm. they're not showing up in court. So when they don't show up, they get a failure to appear, which is a new misdemeanor charge. Mm-hmm. Eventually they'll find them on the street or they get arrested for something else. They bring him back to the jail, which is full. So they cite him out for another date. And sometimes when you look at the docket sheet on some of these petty theft crimes, you can see 7 or 8 failures to appear. Where, you know, they catch them, they give them another date, they don't show up, the judge adds another failure to appear charge, and it goes and goes and goes mm-hmm. until they have so many charges that finally the jail's like, we're not going to let this person out until their case resolves. But I mean, that could take 9 months, a year of this person running around doing whatever they want. Just to give you a story, there was this homeless guy that lived in the town of Gridley about 5-6 years ago. And every morning he would get up and go to Safeway or a liquor store and steal a bottle of booze. And he wound up with dozens of petty theft crimes a year, dozens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if they did catch him, they'd bring him to the police department. They'd do all his paperwork. They'd drop him off at the jail. And usually by noon, he was back in town stealing another bottle.
Oh, wow.
And that's just how he lived. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing they could really do because he wasn't committing more serious other crimes.
So then, I don't know how it works in criminal law, but is there ever a point where racking up so many misdemeanors translates over to a felony or results in some harsher punishment? You said someone can just stack on these misdemeanor charges. Is it just the discretion of the court as to if they really hold to this person? Or is there some stipulation in law that says after this many misdemeanors, here is X, Y, and Z consequences?
Well, there's with misdemeanors, they tend to, they run concurrently. So
okay.
If you wind up being pleading guilty to 10 different misdemeanors, mm-hmm. And they're, a misdemeanor has a maximum 1 year in jail, you're doing 1 year in jail. That's it.
No way.
Right. That's so crazy. Because they're run concurrently. Mm-hmm. Even in felonies, most of them either run concurrently or they're reduced. There's only a handful of crimes where they're required to run consecutively, okay. Meaning that you've got a you actually add them up rather than just run mm-hmm. them together. Mm-hmm. So at some point, you've got some each failure to appear is 6 months. So mm-hmm. when you've got 7 or 8 failures to appear, it just doesn't matter. Even yeah. if they pled guilty to all of them, mm-hmm. Some of their fines and fees would go up. But in terms of actual confinement time, it just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
For someone like you and me, if we wound up spending a night in jail, it would be an extremely traumatic experience that we would remember for the rest of our lives, mm-hmm. right? But for the type of person who is regularly stealing, regularly getting caught mm-hmm. with drugs, going to jail is an inconvenience that they just have to deal with a couple times a month.
Wow.
It's not really a deterrent. It's more of an annoyance.
Yeah. So you're saying, so for a lot of these criminals, after Prop 47 was passed and you're starting to see people go in with their calculators, add up, and steal under the felony amount, are these aren't just like normal people who are coming in like, oh, I can take advantage of the law, or it's more just career criminals who are, you know, they're used to doing this. They would be doing it anyway, but now they know the law and they can stay under a felony charge.
There's always been that low level of petty crime that mm-hmm. People who don't have a criminal lifestyle do. You know, a 19-year-old girl that swipes that cute top from Forever 21.
Sure.
That's always going to happen, but that doesn't have much of an impact on society. They get busted. They get booked and released from the jail. They go on probation for a year, and that's the end of it. The people who are causing the big problem are career criminals and homeless people, mm-hmm. Drug addicts, who, because of their addiction problems, they can't hold down a normal job, but they still need things mm-hmm. in order to survive.
Yeah. That's so interesting because you read in the news, or some of opponents to Prop 36 will say crime in California is down. And if you look at statistics overall, it's down. Theft isn't up. And I talked about in the previous episode that a lot of crime isn't being reported. And so it's hard to really tell, but you're saying from experience, you saw that shift right after Prop 47 was enacted, and it's just been perpetuating ever since, that you are seeing an increase in this type of crime.
Absolutely. And it was immediate. I mean, within wow. hours of Prop 47 going into effect,
really?
We started noticing it. And it's absolutely true. I've got a friend of mine who runs a retail operation at a hardware store. And the police will tell you know, if a retailer catches someone stealing and they call, if there's cops available, they'll come by and they'll arrest them and book them. Mm-hmm. But nine times out of 10, the dispatcher will say, sorry, we don't have anybody available. Log on to our website and you can go ahead and fill out all the paperwork to do a police report.
Wow.
And so by then, of course, the your suspect is gone. There's no mm-hmm. way to find them. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of retailers just, all right, go. And then they write it off and yeah. write, you know, and then our prices go up, insurance prices go up, all of that.
Yeah. That's true. I want to switch over to the drug crime for a second, because we've kind of talked about theft, but there's also the drug possession component. How have you seen that affect your counties? Have you seen kind of an uptick in drug possession, drug use since Prop 47 as well? Kind of what's that like for you?
The drug epidemic that is occurring all over California is one of the great undercover tragedies of our time. The number of overdose deaths that are occurring every day in this state are staggering. As the penalties for possession of personal use quantities have become so small that, again, we're going back to they're just an annoyance for a drug addict that they got to go to jail now and then. There's no real consequences for not doing what you're supposed to do on probation or drug treatment or whatever. As a result, people are using more drugs. Obviously, this happened at the worst time because that's when the fentanyl started really flowing into our communities. And the extent of it is actually, with fentanyl in particular, is kind of masked because Narcan keeps them alive. If it weren't for Narcan, the number of deaths due to overdoses would be just astounding. But at least once or twice a week in our local paper, we'll read about a homeless person that they found in their tent who had passed away. And it's almost always a fentanyl overdose. So those are tragedies that normally when you think about a drug addict, a homeless person, but they affect all layers of society. In our community, we had a couple of years ago when the homeless problem was even worse, there was basically a tent in a park where everyone knew that that's where you went to buy and do drugs. And some local family had their 23, 24-year-old daughter found curled up in a ball in a corner, dead due to an overdose. So it's reaching all strata of society. And many of the tools that we used before Prop 47 are no longer available. One of the most tragic impacts of Prop 47 is that there was the breakdown of what's called the coerced treatment model. So someone gets caught with drugs. They clearly have a pattern of crime that shows that they're an addict. And then there's real consequences hanging over their head with the potential for a felony, with the potential for going away to CDCR for a significant amount of time. It's kind of a myth that people who get caught with a little bit of drugs wind up going to prison for a long time. If that happens, it's someone who's got a long criminal history and has been given many, many chances. If some college kid gets caught with a little bit of cocaine in their pocket, there's what's called PC-1000. Come back in 18 months, and as long as you took 8 hours of drug treatment, there's lots of PC-1000 providers all over the state, then your charges are dismissed as if they never happened. And if you fail on that, back in the days when it could be a felony, then there was drug courts. There was other formal probation programs where you were supervised while you're going off to either residential treatment or sober living environment, whatever it is. But again, there's that extra incentive that if you fail at this, you're not just going to get a couple days in jail and then so long. You're really going to suffer a consequence. Prop 47 took that away. And immediately we started seeing those overdose deaths climb. But the impact isn't just on the addict themselves, too. The impact is also on families. When you have a parent that is constantly strung out on fentanyl or methamphetamine, they're not present for their children, and they're not doing what they need to do to raise them. And now you have another generation of people who are affected by what we just see a drug addict. Well, no, we have a family that's being torn apart by this parent. And then obviously you have the ultimate problem. If one of the parents overdoses, now we've got a mom or a dad that's not going to be in the life of that child. And again, we saw that immediately. Along with that, also, we saw an increase in special victims crimes where because of the drug lifestyle that was being ignored, being allowed to continue, we started seeing an increase in cases involving children. The impacts to our communities are much, much more than just somebody who's got a drug problem. They impact everything in society. And California's experiment with de facto decriminalization has really, really, in my opinion, been a failure.
Yeah, that's so important to understand because we're seeing it's really starting with legislation. So for people who maybe don't care about the laws or who don't read the propositions that are up for on the ballot, you know, it's important to understand these affect your day-to-day life because they might start with affecting law enforcement and prosecutors or district attorneys, but inevitably that's going to trickle down in society, like you're saying, to families and communities. And I'm sure with families, if you have a parent who's a drug addict, now the children are more vulnerable to either gangs or being into drugs themselves, things like that. And so it really is this widespread epidemic that started just with one law or a proposition being passed. So it is important for people to understand what's going on legislatively.
And you know, that's something I really want to praise you for in going through the ballot and explaining to people what these actual propositions mean. Mm-hmm. The year that Proposition 47 passed, I used to get on Facebook every election and break down all the propositions for my friends and family. I remember when I was doing it the year that Prop 47 came out, I hadn't heard anything about it. I knew nothing about it. I want to say it was 2 weeks before the election. I'm sitting here at this computer on Facebook and I'm reading this. And I thought, oh my God, this is horrible.
Yeah.
This is a nightmare. This is a time bomb waiting to go off in our communities. And so I remember I went back to work the following Monday and talked to my boss, the district attorney, and said, hey, have you read Prop 47? He said, oh yeah, I read it. And I said, this is awful. And he goes, you know what? I don't think it's going to pass.
Oh, wow.
But I'll never forget when I first read it. I mean, this is horrible. This can't, and it came out of nowhere and surprised everybody.
Yeah.
There was an individual in the Butte County Jail who he was a bad guy, Aryan Brotherhood gang member, an older guy. He was in his 60s, I think. But he was on an elder abuse charge, which was a felony. But he also had a couple of minor, just personal possession dope cases. But pre-Prop 47, these were felonies. And this gentleman had strikes. So even those his personal quantity cases still could get him 6 years in CDCR in the big boy jail. The elder abuse case went away because the victim died. And as sometimes happens with those cases, obviously a vulnerable elderly victim died. We were obviously not happy about that. We weren't going to be able to hold him accountable for that. But hey, it was okay because we had this drug case. That was pending. And hey, we could get him out of here for a 6-year sentence. He's got a strike. That means 80%. He's going to be gone for at least 5. It's not great, but we can live with that. Prop 47 passed on a Tuesday. He was on calendar on Thursday. And I remember sitting in my office Thursday afternoon and watching him walk right out of the jail.
Oh my. Wow.
Because all of that felony involving that personal use that turned into a misdemeanor. The strike went away and he'd already been in jail for about a year because of the elder abuse case. So he was time served.
Wow. So now he's held accountable for nothing.
Nothing. He walked out of the jail and that was it. Wow. So, I mean, I saw that immediately what impact that had.
Yeah. What do you think is different in public opinion, given that it does seem like an overwhelming majority of voters are polling that they support Prop 36, but there was an initiative on the ballot back in 2020 to do largely the same things that Proposition 36 this election is doing, and it was defeated by a 62% no to 38% yes vote. So what do you think has changed in public opinion since 2020 to where now more of the public favors passing a proposition to undo the effects of Prop 47 from 10 years ago?
The publicity around the smash and grab robberies, obviously, or burglaries, has obviously caught people's attention. But really, it's the homelessness problem. Obviously, if you live in LA, you see a lot of it. Here in Chico, there was always a low level of homelessness around. You know, I think the census was maybe less than 100 homeless people in the entire town back in the day. Post Prop 47, as the types of crimes that homeless people commit were no longer eligible for felonies and for forced treatment or for incarceration, we started to see the level of homelessness rise. Not only that, We have this wonderful invention called a cell phone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's something that everybody who's homeless, you know, they may not have enough food to get through the day, mm-hmm. but their phone is charged. Yeah. And so the news spread like wildfire all throughout the country that, hey, California is the place to go. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not going to hassle you the way they're going to do it in other places. And we started seeing all these guy from Texas, a guy from Florida, a guy from New York. And they were people that had friends or family members that lived in California that had told them, hey, come out here and you can continue your lifestyle without consequence.
Yeah.
So the homelessness problem is there's some out there that call it the housing first crowd mm-hmm. that believe that the reason we have homelessness is because there's a lack of affordable housing. Mm-hmm. It's just not true. Yeah. The reason we have homelessness is because of addiction and mental health problems.
Yeah.
You meet your average homeless person. If you scratch deep enough under the surface, you're going to see addiction and mental health problems. Mm-hmm. And also, in order to stay homeless, they wind up committing a bunch of petty crimes, yeah. a lot of theft. Before Prop 47, the way that California handled its homelessness crisis was with prison. And okay. I'll be the first to tell you that prison is not a great way to handle mental health mm-hmm. and drug addiction problems by itself. Mm-hmm. But it was a way. And with the removal of that consequence, they replaced it with nothing. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, they abandoned this population of very, very needy people mm-hmm. who more than anybody else in our society really needs help from the government, but also needs, on the other hand, for the government to have a consequence for them if they're not making progress in what they're supposed to be doing.
Can you step out for us how that works? How does prison help to address homelessness or addiction? I believe you had called it the coerced treatment model.
The coerced treatment model works. There are studies that show that drug courts, as long as there were serious consequences to noncompliance, worked. Mm-hmm. So the way someone who gets placed on drug probation is they usually wind up getting transferred from the jail to a residential treatment program. Mm-hmm. After a 90-day blackout, the first thing they do, go back to court. And then there's a calendar where all of the people in the drug program they go through all of their cases. And there's mm-hmm. going to be a probation person there, a defense attorney, a prosecutor, and a representative of the program they're in. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell the judge, okay, judge, this person's doing great. They're making lots of progress in their 12 steps. They are working on getting their high school diploma, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if they're not doing those things, well, judge, we've got some hiccups here. You know, the first time the judge will give them a stern talking to, hey, you know, remember, you are potentially staring down 3 years, 6 years in prison. Mm-hmm. You really need to get on the ball. If one of the people on that calendar has really, really, really lost it, mm-hmm. there's a third or fourth violation. They keep testing dirty. They got arrested again with some drugs on them. At some point, finally, the judge goes, you know, I'm sorry, but this program's not helping you. We're going to have to take it up to the next level. We're going to sentence you to prison. Mm-hmm. Everybody else in that room on that calendar sees that.
Yeah.
And they know that that's a possible consequence. Mm-hmm. And so when they go back, drug treatment is difficult. It takes a lot of really hard work and they need to be motivated, one, on the promise of a new life when they finally get to the other side of that addiction, mm-hmm. but also be fearful of the consequences if they don't. There was a colleague of mine who was really, really a big proponent of drug courts. And the way she described it to me was this, is that for drug addicts, rock bottom is usually death. For the ones that don't, you know, that manage to get their stuff together, usually that rock bottom is losing a marriage or the kids don't talk to them or losing a job. But for the serious addicts, that rock bottom is death. Yeah. The point behind the coerced treatment model is to raise that rock bottom to something that's less than death. Mm-hmm. So now you're looking at maybe going and serving a prison term. Mm-hmm. That model is another motivation for people to get clean, and it doesn't work for everybody. We'd see people going through probation and treatment programs over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Some of them, they just never got it, and eventually they just wind up going off to prison. But I got to tell you, you know, as a prosecutor, when you're sitting there in the room with someone you knew just a year ago was an absolute mess, was in danger of having their kids taken away by CPS, was on a path to probably overdose and death. And now they got a new job. Their kids are back with them. They're yeah. clean. The looks on their faces when the judge says, congratulations, you've done great. Your charges are dismissed. Mm-hmm. As a prosecutor, I love seeing that. Yeah. I love seeing the program work. And that was one of the reasons I was so bitter about Prop 47 and what it did, is we don't get those anymore the way we used to.
It's so interesting because so many, I've heard so much of the argument that, well, when it comes to drugs, you know, you're dealing with addiction. And so putting someone, incarceration maybe isn't the answer because, you know, they're addicted, they need help. But it sounds like it's the more compassionate policy really because of these programs. Like you said, it's raising that rock bottom. It's giving them something to work toward that really in the long term, it's a much more helpful approach than just saying, oh, we have compassion, we won't send them to prison or we won't see this as a felony, give them charges. That actually, that's just perpetuating a problem. That's kind of a band-aid, you know, on top of the problem, rather than saying, we'll actually enforce these programs and make them even more effective, even though in the short term, it's a little painful because there's jail time involved or maybe a felony charge.
Exactly. And I'll be the first to tell you that charging people with felonies and sending them off to prison is not the goal. The mm-hmm. goal is to get them clean. But it's also not the only thing. It is one piece of a puzzle that the whole society needs to get behind in terms of adequate funding for drug treatment, adequate mental health counseling. That's a whole nother subject that I could spend hours talking about, is when you have someone with a mental health problem that is not ill enough to be conserved and have the state take away their rights, mm-hmm. but not healthy enough to live a normal, productive life. There's this mm-hmm. huge gray zone, and those people all fall in the cracks. The ones that wind up with a drug or criminal problem, at least there's something we can do to bring them into the system. And, you know, going to prison is terrible, but there's lots of people who were just a complete mess on the streets. They get into prison, they're in a controlled environment where there are options for treatment and mental health care and things like that. So when they come out of that prison sentence, they're in a much better place to actually succeed than they would have been without it. That's not all of them. We can't save everyone by sending them to prison. It just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. Ideally, we wouldn't have to send anybody to prison, but mm-hmm. it's one more tool in a huge toolbox of things that right now in California is missing a lot of tools.
Yeah. What do you think was the issue? You probably know more about this than I do with the history, but when it comes to just even funding the prison system and, you know, before Prop 47, when you had judges trying to say, you know, you have to meet these standards in prisons and thresholds and things, what is preventing us from being able to have maybe the funding or just capacity in prisons to be able to take on, like the criminals before the passage of Prop 47 that created this whole, oh, you know, prisons are overcrowded. Like what really is the cause of that? Is it just a budget issue? Is it more so a priority issue? What's your view on that?
Well, first let me be completely upfront with you. The problems that the Brown v. Plata court were addressing were real. The amount of people that were incarcerated in California prisons was astronomical. And back in the 80s and even into the 90s, they dealt with it by building new prisons, mm-hmm. But they're super expensive. Not only is the physical part of the prison expensive, but the staff to run it is expensive. And then you're talking about a whole staff that's going to be civil service workers on CalPERS is going to be their retirement system. Yeah. And that's really expensive. So on the one hand, you've got the fiscal hawks who don't want to pay for it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you've got justice reform types who don't want to be sending people in prison in the first place. So there's lots mm-hmm. of headwinds pushing back on that. And even Governor Schwarzenegger had announced, we're not going to build any new prisons. Not only that, at some point, he even shut down the Correctional Officers Academy. So there was no new prison guards being trained because they thought at the time they were going to be able to get by on just what we had. Mm-hmm. A lot of that did change. That being said, Governor Newsom's already shut down 3 prisons. Mm-hmm. There were older prisons that were going to take a lot of money to improve, but we have less beds than we did when AB 109 passed. Mm-hmm. When I tell you that Prop 36 is not a panacea, this is part of what I mean, is that we're going to have more people going to prison, but there's no plans to increase our capacity for handling them. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be something that California is just going to have to address should Prop 36 pass.
What would you say to people who oppose the proposition for those reasons of, well, it's just going to create overcrowding, so we shouldn't even pass it in the first place.
Traditionally in CDCR, while there were some programs for inmates to address drug issues, mental health issues, job training issues, before Prop 47 and AB 109, because of that incredible overcrowding, it just wasn't possible to effectively reach the inmates you needed to reach. Mm-hmm. Now I'm hopeful that with a smaller population, mm-hmm. and hopefully if our drug courts and probation is working correctly, it won't be a tsunami, it'll be a trickle, that CDCR will have more resources for handling those more difficult projects when they get to prison. So that would be, that is a big issue that I know there is funding mechanisms that are in the new Prop 36 to kind of address that, but I think we're going to find it's not enough. And so we may be coming back a year from now, 2 years from now, with another budget problem with trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to fund this program.
Yeah. And ultimately we can't just shy away from solving one issue because it creates maybe another issue. You know, if you are seeing such an increase in these thefts and drug crime, and it has such an impact on our communities, then I think it's really important for people to understand it might have, you know, some issues we have to work out in the future that definitely need to be addressed, but we should take those on like boldly and not be afraid of addressing really what's becoming the root cause of the issue instead of just putting Band-Aid fixes over the top. We'll just end up with crime all over, you know, with none of it ever being addressed if we're too afraid to start at the beginning, which is saying these are crimes and need to be punished.
Exactly. So Prop 36 is not the end of the road, but it is an important first step. For those of your listeners, I would encourage you to speak to your family, your friends, get on Facebook or Instagram or X, formerly known as Twitter, whatever, yeah. And let everyone know how important this law is. Of all the laws that you're going to vote on this year in terms of ballot propositions, this will absolutely have the biggest impact on your quality of life. Mm-hmm. I will make my prediction, and if you want to, maybe we'll come back in a year and have another conversation about this, but I do predict that if Prop 36 passes, there will be a noticeable change in the level of homelessness and the level of low-level crime that's going on in our communities. Hopefully, we'll also start seeing it in the overdose statistics. Hopefully, we'll start seeing it in terms of some of our more dangerous crimes.
Can you just step out for people, like, what if Prop 36 passes, how that's going to change your day-to-day or just your job? Like, what would be the next steps that what would be the difference that you would see immediately you go into your job and what would be different?
As a prosecutor, I have a caseload. I have files, either computerized or paper, where each one of them represents a person who got busted doing something they weren't supposed to do. Right now, let's say someone gets pulled over with a pound of methamphetamine in their car. They're going to be charged with 11378, 11379 of the health safety code. So either 4 years or 5 years of county prison. And especially if they spend meaningful time in custody before the case resolves, then once they finally do resolve it, you know, assuming they get the maximum sentence, they're only looking at maybe a year of being wearing an ankle monitor. That's not much of an incentive. It's also not much of an incentive for them to enter a plea and do a negotiated settlement, because the worst consequences they're looking at is a couple more months in jail and then an ankle monitor. Before Prop 47, before AB 109, 4 years meant a possibility of actually 2 years in CDCR. And so we would make an offer, hey, we're going to give your guy a shot on probation. And they would take that because they didn't want to go to prison. Now, if they've got a bunch of pre-custody credits and only looking at another 90 days in jail, I'll just plead guilty. Or I'll just burn up time in jail since I know it's going to be credited towards my eventual sentence anyway, and I won't resolve my case. So the same guy comes on calendar again and again and again. We set it for trial, and then at the last minute, there's a continuance, and the cases aren't resolving because the penalties aren't that are not heavy enough to motivate them to resolve their cases. For us personally, once we get that leverage, I think that's going to give us the opportunity to really craft plea deals with an incentive for people to either get clean or remove them from our society for a period of time in order to give everybody some peace. And the other side is that the public defenders, they'll have some credibility when they turn to their clients and say, you need to take this deal. Mm-hmm. So I see that as being a very positive impact on what I do, what the defense attorneys do, but also what the courts do. There'll be just less cases going through on those calendars every week.
Yeah. What do you think about different district attorneys and different approaches? I think for me, when I think of a prosecutor or a district attorney, there's this picture of someone who's tougher on crime. You know, you're obviously the ones who are prosecuting the criminals. But in other parts of California, like here in Los Angeles, or we see in San Francisco, we have DAs who take a softer on crime approach, and maybe they, you know, agreed with Proposition 47 and are against Prop 36. Where do you think they differ philosophically? And in your view, is there any incentive, maybe monetarily or politically, to take an approach that would say, no, Prop 36, you know, is going to have negative effects, and so we're going to keep with the current laws, even though we're seeing, you know, clear increases in theft or drug crime?
Well, I can say for sure, the prosecutors that work at LA County are at war with your district attorney, to the point where they're actually suing him over some of his policies. Mm-hmm. And the courts have actually sided with the line prosecutors on some of these mm-hmm. cases. Obviously, George Gascon is an outlier. Mm-hmm. We saw what happened to Chesa Boudin in San Francisco.
Yeah.
San Francisco removed a prosecutor who was soft on crime. And so Alameda County, he's looking at that this year, the potential for, I can't remember her name. So those folks, they basically decided that their job wasn't to get elected to enforce the law. Their job was to get elected to slow down the law, to prevent people from being held accountable. And they have these beliefs that the system is inherently racist, that it's unfair. And I'll be the first to tell you that the impacts on different communities are there. They're real. Mm-hmm. Now, as to the reason why, some people will tell you that it's racism. Some people will tell you that it's economics. Some people will tell you there's other social issues. And we could go on for hours and hours about that. But it is true that heavier penalties do impact different communities differently. Just does. Mm-hmm. But also the flip side of that is failure to enforce laws in those communities has a bigger impact on those communities. Mm-hmm. When someone who's a drug dealer who runs a corner downtown or, you know, in the hood, mm-hmm. That person going away to prison is going to buy a lot of peace for that neighborhood for at least a couple of years. Mm-hmm. When the person's never going to prison, is not afraid of prison, then that negative impact on your community is going to be out on that street corner night after night after night, and all the other problems that brings with it. So it's a complicated issue. Mm-hmm. Mr. Gascon, I do believe he's got I know he survived a recall. But those prosecutors, what happens in those communities is very different. Even a more sensible jurisdiction like Santa Clara, got a very different approach to what we would do in a place like Sutter County. We are about holding people accountable in a way that they're just not. Another aspect we didn't really get into much is that the base penalties in California for felonies is usually kind of low compared to the national standard. Where it really starts to rack up is when you start adding the enhancements. Mm-hmm. Three strikes law, used to have call it dope with prior dope. So you got caught selling dope, but you had in the past, you'd been convicted of it once before. Mm-hmm. That meant we could add three more years. Mm-hmm. If you'd been to prison, every time you'd been to prison, that was one more year. Mm-hmm. So you could actually stack up this one guy. I want to say he was pre Prop 47. He was looking at 17 years in state prison. Mm-hmm. Post Prop 47, he's looking at 4 years in county prison. Wow. Same guy, same record. Mm-hmm. And so, in a lot of those jurisdictions that are taking a softer on crime approach, they don't let their prosecutors allege enhancements. So the same crime that occurs on one side of the county line could result in 20 years. On the other side of the county line, you might be looking at seven. And that's just crazy. And that's just based on what the local prosecutor is willing to do in terms of these enhancements. Mm-hmm. We used to joke, I interned for the San Francisco DA's office in 2006 and 2007. Yes, I have ridden alone in an elevator with the woman that's running to be president of the United States.
Really?
Yes. I won't tell you I know her well. Yeah. You know, we just made, you know, chit chat, just kind of small talk. But I, you know, I got to see her up close and see her dressing crowds and stuff. She actually gave the commencement speech at my law school graduation.
Wow,
so I'm very very familiar with Kamala Harris. Everyone knew back then in the early 2000s, drug dealers did not cross John Daly Boulevard. They knew that if they're on the San Francisco side selling drugs, the consequences were one thing. If they were in San Mateo County, because they'd stepped across John Daly Boulevard into Daly City, it was a whole nother world.
Wow.
And that means that has drug dealers and other criminals are sophisticated, and they take that kind of thing into account. They really will make sure that they are committing their crimes in a jurisdiction where they're going to see less consequences than another one.
Wow. That's so interesting. It's how much does it vary then? Because obviously legislation is one thing, like it can take away like the teeth that you have to be able to prosecute crime. But then how much does it matter that your district attorney, you know, takes a certain approach? Like even though the laws maybe not be in your favor for prosecuting certain crimes, does it still help to have a district attorney who's more tough on crime, like wants to see these programs through, wants to believe in kind of rule of law, or does it not matter as much and it's all just legislation?
It matters a huge amount. When your district attorney is committed to enforcing the law and using all the tools that are on the books, the consequences that someone who's arrested and accused of a crime in your county are enormously different, depending on the philosophy of the DA. The better DAs, like the one I work for, Jennifer Dupre, she's very, very committed to those problem-solving courts of trying to get people drug treatment, battered treatment programs for domestic abusers. We don't want to just send people to prison and just get them out of the community, because we know that, and except in the most serious crimes, they're going to wind up back in the community eventually.
Yeah.
It's always a better idea to try to have a positive impact on their life and just crush them. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's some folks out there who are just not going to get it unless there is a potential huge consequence hanging over their head, or if they're people who just are not interested in change, we need to remove them from the community for as long as we can to give everybody else some peace. A big part of that is recruiting and hiring new prosecutors, training new prosecutors, the kind of prosecutors that are willing to work in your jurisdiction. I got to tell you, when Chesa Boudin took over at the San Francisco DA's office, there was a massive exodus of most of their most senior experienced prosecutors, because they didn't want to work for someone who wasn't interested in prosecuting crime. So that was a massive change in terms of public safety in San Francisco.
That makes a lot of sense. And really, that's why it's more important than ever for us to be informed on who we're voting for. If our district attorneys will really want to uphold the law and push forward those programs, like you're saying, and then vote for the right representatives. Are there any last words you'd like to say to my listeners on Proposition 36 before we close out our conversation?
In terms of Prop 36, I just really encourage everyone to learn about it. There's lots of resources available out there. The California District Attorneys Association has got lots of resources, but we really do have a chance to change our state for the better come next Tuesday. And depending on how that goes, our lives can be really, really impacted for the better. But also the lives of the people in the criminal justice system, will have an opportunity to reach them and potentially change their lives in positive ways that we just can't do now.
Yeah, I love that message. That's so important. Thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me and talk through all of this with me. And thank you for the work that you do as, you know, as a prosecutor and then now in the district attorney, under the district attorney. It's just so important and obviously affects your community and makes a big difference depending on how you're approaching laws and crimes for, like you said, everyone involved, the offenders and the victims of things. So I just think that's amazing work. So I really appreciate it. But thank you for this conversation. It was awesome to get to talk to you. You are a wealth of knowledge.
Well, first, Tess, thank you for what you do. Getting out there and explaining this stuff to people, to voters who may not know or have the resources. It's such a great way. You just spend a half an hour in the car on the way to work or whatever. Yeah. Pop in Tess's podcast, California Conversations. And it's just really, really good stuff. It's concise. Hopefully, as your audience grows and you get a little more reach and you can talk to more people, you can have an even bigger impact on your community than you do now.
Yeah, definitely. That's the hope. Thank you so much for listening to this special episode of the show. I hope that you found that conversation as fascinating and enlightening as I did, and that you're feeling even more equipped and motivated to vote yes on Proposition 36 this coming Tuesday. I really loved that all throughout our discussion, what Jeff was saying kept pulling us back to the core idea that legislation matters. It really matters that you understand the laws in our state, because even when it feels like a law won't affect you, from today's conversation, it is so clear that our laws do have trickle-down effects on society, and therefore on you. Make a plan right now for when you will go to the ballot box and make your voice heard, because it is so important in this election. And lastly, I'll see you back here on Tuesday for a very important Election Day episode, and then after that, we will begin diving into new legislation passed for next year. All of that and more coming up right here on the California Conversation.